Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live, this Tuesday edition, a little bit about the millennials, some of their economic habits, and also some old-timey jobs that are coming back that people are trying to do again. Also, a lot has happened on this day in history. We're going to take a look at a few of those events that are important and a lot more to discuss that and additional stories on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Thanks for joining us there. And you can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. Also, email us comments at kpcg.fm. We are happy to take a look at those. Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And you guys, of course, are into the hockey. And Nashville's won the last two games, so it's a tied series. So we've got a series.
Yeah, it's best out of three now. Whoever can win two out of the next three games. And it's been really odd because Pittsburgh won the first two games 5-1 and then 4-1 or 3-1.
I think it was 5-3 and 4-1.
Right. And then Nashville just won the last two games 5-1, 4-1. So
blowouts in hockey terms.
Yeah, and they've been closer games probably than what the scores indicate, but just lot flip-flopping back and forth, whoever has home ice advantage. So it's just a really exciting series.
At least something's interesting this time of year when it comes to sports.
We're in line to have our predictions correct still. We both said the Predators in six games. So
yeah,
that's still possible if the Predators win the next two.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I probably got swept up in the media hype, but I did think maybe the Cavaliers could win the finals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they win Wednesday, maybe we got something, but I don't know. They got to figure something out quick, or it's not looking good.
It would be shocking if that series ended up in a sweep, but who knows the way it's been playing out so far.
It could happen. Now the old-timey guys are jumping on board and talking about, was our team better than this current Warriors team? There's a write-up that says, 2017 Warriors or Jordan's 96 Bulls, the Vegas odds makers are picking sides. I don't know why you'd bother, because it's never going to happen. I could say for sure that the 2017 Warriors right now today could beat the Bulls from 96 because they're so old. So maybe that's what they're talking about. Jordan's still got the will. He just doesn't have the body anymore. But they say the biggest factor, if they actually played in their primes, they say, is what rules the game was being played under. If you were able to hand check, the Bulls would probably be the favorite. Their roster was built for that, hand-checking defense. In the no-hand-check era, the Warriors' current roster is much better suited and would have some serious speed and shooter advantages at several key positions. That's always a hard thing when you're comparing teams from different eras or players. The game changes a little bit. So if you can hand-check, okay. If you can't hand-check, now maybe it goes the other way.
Yeah, it would be interesting to figure that out because, obviously, it still stands that the Warriors have four All-Stars and the Bulls, I think, only had two. I'm pretty sure it was Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen were the only two All-Stars on that team. But at the same time, it's a lot easier for someone like Stephen Curry to take a lot of shots and make them, and he can showboat all he wants to and not get hit when he goes down the lane, like would have used to happen in 20 years ago.
I do have to admit, I did like his little funny celebration. He threw a really nice pass last game, and he put the goggles up to his eyes like, I see you. I thought that was pretty funny. But I would like to see actually what Dennis Rodman would do with Kevin Durant. Dennis Rodman was a really tough player, and he just was so good at getting people's heads and messing with them. And he had Karl Malone trying to fight him in the finals. They actually tried to wrestle, so he was just really good at getting under the skin and disrupting the teams. Magic Johnson weighed in. He said his Showtime Lakers would probably sweep the Golden State Warriors. So that's an interesting debate as well.
It's always good to hear them have that kind of confidence, but it's probably not realistic.
It would be really interesting to see, again, what rules are we playing with. I personally think the prime era Shaq Kobe Lakers, that would be an interesting matchup because Kobe could guard somebody and they'd have no answer for Shaq. You know, you can't put Durant on him or Zaza, but he just run through both of them. So, but again, you know, trading twos for threes. I don't know. It'd be interesting. We'll never know. Maybe the Cavaliers can get some help. They get Magic Johnson on their team and Michael Jordan, bring Abdul-Jabbar back and see if they could if they could win. I don't know. Yeah, it seems like the NBA might have to extend that 3-point line or do something. You know, it's funny. There used to be a time when there wasn't a 3-point line. Totally changed the game. There's no need to pull up from so deep, but now that's the main part of the game. Like somebody was saying, I think maybe you were even mentioning yesterday, those big centers are no longer viable anymore. You know, you need to be able to shoot a three-pointer and handle the ball from the three-point line when you're 7 feet tall. There's not a lot of guys that can do that.
Yeah, that is a little bit irritating, especially for teams that have really built themselves around having a lot of size, kind of like the Thunder, actually. Mm. And then the last few years, it has gotten to where every team has to be just prolific at shooting threes, and that's pretty much where the Thunder is horrible.
Yeah. Different times when it comes to the way the different games are played. Into some other news and information today, there's a report coming out. This is just sort of happening as we're doing this live. The replay in the afternoon, it won't be probably as urgent, but right now they say reports, this is from CNN, reports say police have shot and injured an attacker outside the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. So there'll be more information about that, I'm sure, as the day goes on. And anytime anything happens, the first thought, of course, is terrorism. Don't know any details about it yet, but that's what people are looking at to see what's happening there. So it is pretty interesting. And, of course, the terror attack from Saturday night is still in the news. I was looking at this Time magazine. This is it's from a couple weeks back already. And this one, one of the big feature stories is on the last attack in Manchester there. They just have one little quote here. Charlie Falconer is from the Labour Party. He says, the sheer brutality of the Manchester attack will impact very considerably our views of ourselves and our country. So they come out with those statements. But then everyone's probably almost forgotten about that one because there's been another one. So it's hard to keep up even with the magazines or anything because they're happening so fast. So it's almost already obsolete.
Yeah, it's a lot of other people have said this too, but in the light of a terrorist attack, a lot of people, they have a routine. They have the nice phrases they put on Twitter. The government has this statement where they can condemn it in the strongest terms. And then there's a memorial for the victims a few days after, and that's it. And it's this cycle we get in, but what happens if they happen once a week? You always keep doing those same things. What's the value in them if you're just doing it for a show, really? I mean, I'm sure everyone's sincere in what they say, but that's those memorials and nice sentiments on social media aren't going to stop terrorism. So we're kind of getting to this point where we need action. And just yesterday I watched a documentary on September 11th, and that was just horrific because I was only 10 years old or so when it happened. And so I remember it, though, very clearly from what I could understand as a young kid back then. But it changed the whole world, and people demanded action. There wasn't just words. President Bush said a lot of strong words, but the whole nation in America demanded action. And we're not seeing that right yet, so it'll be interesting to see if how much more it takes for people to have that same kind of reaction like they did after the defining terrorist moment of our lives.
Yeah. That's what it used to be, is sort of there would be an attack and then you'd have a year or two. So there would be time for the remembrances and the memorials, but now it's coming so quickly.
And an attack used to actually unify people. That's right. A big difference as well. I mean, even back in 2001 when that 9/11 attack did occur, it seemed like the partisan sniping died down a lot for a few weeks, and then it got back to normal. But now you have people blaming the United States president for an attack that happened in Britain, and you have people calling him out for not addressing the gun problem after a knife attack. It's just insane. That doesn't even make any sense to any sound-minded individual, and yet that's how they're trying to still twist the story back to the president.
Well, the Washington Post, their email that they send, you know, with their headlines today, I just scrolled through it. A lot of times I don't even look because it's so negative, but I just scrolled through it. And I don't know how many they featured. Let's say there were 10. I don't know. At least 8 of them were anti-Trump. That was their whole thing. Just some really outlandish headlines too. That there's no way I don't know how far you can get before it's libel. You know, where you're just saying things that are wildly crazy. There is a point where you're not supposed to be able to do that. Some of those headlines were, I think, probably close to that. I don't know the legalities there. But keep in mind, all this is happening a day or two after a terror attack in London, and their whole anger and fury is at the way the president has responded to it instead of the actual attack itself. It just seems out of balance, to say the least.
That British politician you mentioned did touch on a good point about possibly engaging in some self-reflection after an attack, but that is really not taking place at all. People are still bickering. They're still trying to push ideologies instead of figuring out why these things are happening. That's not in any way to justify terrorism at all, but is this a curse that people need to figure out what to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, when attacks come as quickly as they are, you don't have time to really stop and think, or to have these memorials and that type of thing. It's, you know, it is a war, really. And you think about, we're going to talk about World War II here in a little bit because of this day in history, but, you know, if you're in a battle, you don't have time to stop every time somebody dies, sadly, because that's a terrible situation you're in. And it's almost to that point with the terror attacks. We don't even have time to stop and think about what just happened because another one's coming right around the corner.
Yeah, we're getting to the place where societies are resembling more of those in the Middle East. Like Israel is the closest example, or even other countries, to where that's where you have terrorist groups living for the past 40, 50 years. And our society is starting to resemble those more, to where there's police presence on the street, there's different kinds of measures that have to be taken to stop terrorism, and there's no other way to do it. And those aren't necessarily bad things. But when our society is trying to resemble places that we don't want them to, not saying those countries are bad, but we do have a way of life we're proud of in America, Britain, like the way our societies function, the openness and the freedom people have to go a lot of places. And we should ask ourselves, well, what's going on here? What trajectory are we on? And where are the solutions? And there just aren't a lot of solutions. There's just a lot of words, a lot of platitudes and cliches. There aren't any action plans. And I think that's what a lot of people are getting frustrated about, is that there's just no leader. Even President Trump has a little bit, but he hasn't really been very clear about it. No president said, we're going to do this, and that's our goal for the next year. We're just going to do this, and that's going to stop it. Because they're afraid of being attacked for stepping on someone's toes, or the opposition won't even give them a chance to trying to make a play at stopping terrorism.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's what I was going to say, was that if you put out an action plan, it would be attacked immediately by the media. They would have a field day with it. They can't even handle a strongly worded statement. So, interesting. Shifting gears here a little bit, looking at some economic news. Some businesses of the past are starting to not have the same market they used to. There's a few examples. They talk about golf courses, of all things. People just don't golf, I guess, anymore. Malls, we've talked about that. And so everyone's blaming the millennials. It's your guys' fault for not spending money in those places. So Business Insider takes a look at the millennials' economic habits and has a few ideas about why they do what they do. But one thing here is for sure, that 7 in 10 students graduate from college with student loan debt, owing an average of over $30,000, according to the Institute for College Access and Success. And that's ignoring the massive debt of students who took out loans but did not graduate. So that happens a lot too, where they take out the money and they don't graduate. As student loan debt has skyrocketed, income, both for graduates and millennials who haven't attended college, has failed to substantially increase. With these economic burdens, it is difficult for millennials to save money. 31% of young millennials aged 18 to 24 and 33% of older millennials 25 to 34, you guys are old millennials, by the way, don't have any money in their savings account, according to Go Banking Rates. Debt and a lack of money in savings obviously makes it harder to make major investments, such as buying houses or cars. And so the housing market, even though there's a lot of people trying to get houses at this point, but some of the younger people aren't getting into the market as much, or they're not buying cars, new cars, and things like that. They don't have the money for it. They're paying student debt. And then they're kind of living for today, too. And just they use the example of the infamous avocado toast. Apparently, this is a thing. But they'd rather spend the 10 bucks on that and the latte and not worry about the future. And so some businesses are drying up, they think, because of that spending habits.
It's kind of understandable why a lot of young college socialists would be crusading for free college, because it really is so outrageously expensive now, and it does put people on the back foot coming out of college. And there are countries like Australia that do provide free college, free, but obviously someone always has to pay for it. I think what a lot of those young students don't understand is that if they get free college, they're also going to be taxed so highly once they get out of college for the rest of their lives to pay for what they thought was free college.
Somebody foots the bill at the end of the day. And related to that, this is a Wall Street Journal write-up. Why old-timey jobs are hot again. I like old-timey. I just like that. Rolls off the tongue. They say in his new book, Masters of Craft, Old Jobs in the New Urban Economy, this author, Mr. Osejo, hope I said that right, examines the forces driving a resurgence of occupations such as butcher and bartender among young middle-class urbanites. A similar dynamic is at work with a handful of other jobs, including craft brewing, for beer, I imagine, bookbinder, that's interesting, furniture maker and fishmonger. That last one sounds illegal, but I guess it's not. You're a fishmonger. Millennials are drawn to these occupations, they say, in part as a reaction to the of the digital age. We'll just say that. He threw a word in there, which I'm like, I can't pronounce that one. The author is a sociology professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the City University of New York Graduate Center. So he's taking a look at some of these what you would call old-timey jobs, and some people in the millennial age group are eschewing the IT job, and they say, oh, you know, I want to be a butcher. I mean, if there's a market for it, I think that's okay. I think it's good.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting, because I know my friends growing up with them, their spending habits were obscure, or they decided to live in places with lots of other young people, and so they're not investing their money in the same old things that maybe their parents did, but they're tending to gather in the same places. And when you have lots of people in the community, that's when entrepreneurship comes alive, or these businesses can revive, because in that community you need certain things. And so people have a chance to be a butcher or a fishmonger or wherever they want to be. And so although it's their habits have changed and all that is good, it is revitalizing some of these cities and some of these places where these jobs are back in demand again, because they're all flocking to the same place.
Well, and you know, I think everybody kind of wants to be unique in a way, and so people like their lattes or whatever. But Starbucks is kind of everybody goes to Starbucks, right? So when you get the specialty coffee shop, and you've got the people there that it's a craft to them, and it's sort of an environment that I think a lot of people do like. I guess the coffee's better. But it's sort of, you know, I've been to a few places like that, and you can kind of see it there, that the people take real pride in what they're doing, which I think is good. I'd rather have somebody that takes pride in it as opposed to somebody who's just punching the clock to, you know, pay the student debt or whatever. So I think some of those things can be neat. There's a comment on the story where this person is saying that they think it's not a bad idea, also because some of those jobs are more apprenticeship based, where you could go and work as an apprentice and learn, and maybe you don't need to go to college and get a degree in something that might be ridiculous. Now, there's a lot of good degrees, but there's a lot that are kind of frivolous, I guess, but you're still paying to get them. And sometimes it might be better to just become a an intern somewhere or an apprentice and learn something by doing it.
Yeah, that is a really good point. A lot of universities, they do have apprenticeship programs for trades or engineering and those types of classes. But there aren't a lot. I'm not sure if you can be an apprentice to be a psychologist or a social media manager, all these things. I'm sure there can be, but
you just have to lay on the couch next to the guy on the other couch.
Yes.
And listen.
Yeah.
That's the apprenticeship.
Yeah, learn how to clean out the pipe and fill up the brandy decanter. But yeah, it's just kind of a different world, but that is a really good point, though, that it could help businesses stay in business, too, because the master butcher can pass his trade on to someone else who can do it well. And so it can help these small businesses stay alive. And those small businesses are really what make America. It's not really the corporate America. It's the small businesses that really make the fabric of America as we know it.
Yeah. Everybody seems to be getting pushed into certain fields of work, but there are a lot of different jobs out there. If there is a market for it, and like this author is saying, talking about these old-timey jobs, he said a lot of them are not necessarily coming in and, say, replacing the bigger butcher or something, but they're kind of a building right next to it, you know, in sense of, okay, well, that's the big company that's doing whatever, but I kind of like this specialty guy too. So they're kind of building right next to some jobs that are already there. So anyway, it's something to think about. Here's an answer to a question that you maybe have not asked or want to know the answer to, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Because I have thought about it, and I saw this little write-up, and I thought, oh, it's an answer to a question I had. You ever in the grocery store, and you have a hankering for a snack of some kind, and you see the little beef jerky thing at the checkout, or the little beef stick thing?
Yes.
And you look at it, and you're seeing what's in it, and it says mechanically separated chicken.
Mm-hmm.
You ever seen that?
Yeah.
You guys know what that is?
I think so.
I've always wondered.
You're going to find the answer. I always had a vision of chickens being taken apart by a machine. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I don't care who separates it. But there's more to it than that. According to the USDA, mechanically separated poultry is a paste-like and batter-like poultry product produced by forcing bones with attached edible tissue, edible in quotes, by the way, through a sieve or a similar device, under high pressure to separate bone from the edible tissue, which is then treated with a small amount of ammonium hydroxide as an antimicrobial agent. The definition of edible tissue is stretching it a bit here, they say, as it is essentially refers to anything left on the bones, including nerves, blood vessels, cartilage, and skin, as well as maybe a small amount of meat. The resulting product is the poultry equivalent of lean, finely textured beef, also known as pink slime.
Oh.
It's probably not the... Yeah, I can see why they changed the name. Even though the production method is different, consumption of mechanically separated beef was banned in 2004 due to fears of mad cow disease. Mechanically separated meat, which also includes pork products, is found in plenty of foods, including chicken nuggets, frozen preformed chicken patties. But while there's a limit on mechanically separated pork and hot dogs, 20%, there's no legal limit on mechanically separated chicken in hot dogs. So you may want to check the ingredients list before your next cookout, they say. So it's not just chicken taken apart by machines. In fact, it's not really chicken at all. It's bones and some of the things that are on the bones.
You have to commend these factories for being so economical and getting everything off the bone like that, although maybe it's not the most ideal thing for the consumers to be eating.
Yeah, the fact that they changed the name of pink slime to lean, finely textured beef is probably a good idea. Guys, we're having a hard time marketing this pink slime.
Yeah, it's maybe that's what all that stuff in Ghostbusters 2 was that they found underneath New York City.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just amazing what, like Grant said, they're trying to get every little piece of the animal so they can save money. And package in these foods that they're not advertised as healthy food. Everyone knows hot dogs aren't great and the beef sticks aren't good. And that most of those beef hot dogs and beef sticks have chicken in them. But it's just, it's quick, it's easy, and you don't really think about what you're eating. But it does show just another issue with the ethics of food production in this country, to where they're willing to sacrifice health for just saving a little bit of money on the chicken.
So next time you're in the, you see the Slim Jim, you may not want to step into it. Like the Macho Man said.
Step into it.
Step into the pink slime. Today is the 6th of June, and a lot of important things that happened on this day in history. This one, most of them tying into World War II. This first one doesn't. It's just interesting. 1816 on this day, 10 inches of snow fell in New England. Talk about global warming. part of a year without a summer, which followed the eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia. So they had the eruption there, and they had a whole year without a summer. That's bad for the kids. Summer break, and you're out in the snow. So that was in 1816. So it's interesting. I mean, definitely weather, you know, there's weather issues that come up, and probably more so now than in the past. But if you take a peek back in history, it's not like, oh, the sky is falling. In 1816, they didn't have a summer. Did they have to have the climate agreement after that, or did they just wait a year?
How do you think scientists would have explained that? Maybe because the eruption caused so much heat that somehow the reaction was severe extreme cold? I don't really know, but that really is something that maybe people should take a look at. There are a lot of events like that that have forced them to change the term global warming to climate change.
Right. It's I have the climate changing in my house all the time. Turn the AC on, turn it off. So that was an interesting event there in 1816. But most of the bigger things that happened on this day were from World War II. D-Day, 1944. And quite a few things happened on that day. 82nd Airborne Division, World War II D-Day landing occurred. Major League Baseball canceled all their games, obviously, honoring the D-Day invasion. Operation Neptune, 150,000 strong Allied Expeditionary Force lands in Normandy, France. Nazi troops executed 96 prisoners by firing squad the same day. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. received the Congressional Medal of Honor. And German submarines U-955, U-970, U-629, and U-373 sink in the Bay of Biscay. So a lot happening. June 6, 1944. Some of it talked about on the Trumpet Daily Show today.
Yeah. D-Day, probably the most famous date in all of World War II history, I think, especially for Americans. And a lot of people today still have family members. My great uncle landed on Juneau Beach as a field ambulance attendant with the North Shore Regiment from New Brunswick. And he survived and died quite a few years ago. But lots of people partake of that and a proud part of our history. And it's always just a good reminder on days like this, just when our societies are under threat of violence and attack, that there was a time when we took action and these ordinary men did something pretty extraordinary. And the hardest thing for a soldier to do is an amphibious landing. Because you have to wade through water. You're on a beach with no cover. Usually the enemy have machine guns and artillery and everything. And so especially a lot of Americans died on D-Day at Omaha Beach. And they certainly did something that they didn't think maybe, well, I think all of them knew it would be part of history, but I don't think any of them knew it would be as successful as it was.
Yeah, and it we mentioned it yesterday a little bit, but it does highlight that history highlights the difference between the attitude back then and what it is today in the West, where, you know, there's this terror attack in the UK or several of them. And they're kind of proud and saying, well, we withstood the Nazis and this isn't going to deter us. But yeah, we went over and invaded today and attacked and took the fight to them. It didn't just sit there. So that's the difference when they talk about that. It is a noble history that they bring up, but I think they're missing the point of what was noble about it. It wasn't just sitting there and taking punches. It was going after the Nazis.
Yeah, and even that history is under attack. Like with the Churchill movie we've talked about, which is about D-Day, how they portray Churchill as a basically a defeatist or someone who's scared of to take the offensive, which is the exact opposite of everything he was. In fact, he wanted to be in the HMS Ramillies during the bombardment and observe and then land on the beaches the same day as the troops. He was going to land on the beaches right behind the troops on D-Day to be with them. That doesn't sound like someone who's not for the invasion or someone who has any ounce of fear in them about it at failing. He wanted to be there because he was a warrior. And then Churchill was also one who led them through the Blitz. And that's the kind of leadership we need. Like, that's the kind of leader and the kind of type of example we should be looking to and not be focusing on political correctness and tweets and all these other things.
Well, and even with that history of Churchill, one of the most infamous parts of his history is that he was called a warmonger before the war because he warned that there was going to be problems, and people didn't like that. They shouted him down. The young people did in particular. And so here you have Neville Chamberlain coming back and saying, oh, we're going to have peace. Oh, don't worry about it. We'll be fine. And then they get themselves into this war, get attacked. Does anyone see a parallel to today? Keep calm and carry. Does anyone see a parallel that maybe instead of attacking somebody and calling them an alarmist or whatever, they pay attention to the signs that are all around everybody?
What nation could ever retain any respect by preaching these empty platitudes like that while just letting the enemy attack them repeatedly? And they don't do anything. They don't respond with actions. They just respond with words. Clearly, those are politicians separated from the people. They don't usually experience the direct results of the attacks, and so they don't really care. That's the bottom line of it.
It is some good history to look back on, June 6th, D-Day, and there's more about that on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up here in a bit. Also, make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story today, new video exposes abortion horror. Grant, we talked about that last week. And some related issues to that, excruciating pain during an abortion question, and a chilling peek at our abortion culture. That's at thetrumpet.com. Also, Abraham, you have a write-up today. The Washington Post gets the Korean War all wrong. The real history of America's forgotten war. The great Washington Post, and you think they got it wrong?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I have a suspicion. So, well, since they don't have their internal watchdog anymore, they probably... hopefully look to social media for some fact-checking.
Yeah, it's well, and so that's a really good piece that you have there. And we talked about that a while ago. Obviously, you get into more detail, but just the fact that that writer for the Washington Post said that North Korea may have a point.
Yeah.
Don't think so. But so anyway, check that out at thetrumpet.com. It's a good write up, and we'll see what kind of response you get to it.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see if they do anything on social media. They probably won't.
Washington Post.
Yeah. But see if there's any kind of response to it. But yeah, it's just we've been talking about apologists in history a lot, and it would be maddening for someone to say that about World War II, to say that. Nazi Germany had a point because we bombed them into smithereens. It's the same logic, and in fact people attack the West about that same point, but with Korea they're a little more emboldened to do it. But it's on a day like this, D-Day, it is to remind us of the sacrifice our troops have made for us, and that's not just World War II, but all the sacrifice our troops have made. It's not something to apologize for or to kind of defame their sacrifice with saying the enemy has a point.
Yeah, for sure. Make sure you check that out at thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us today. You can follow us on Twitter, KPCGFM. And if you'd like to send us a comment, you can send those to comments at kpcg.fm. And, of course, you can comment on articles right there at the Trumpet. So maybe we'll take a look at some of the comments you get tomorrow. Grant, you've got a write-up here for us from the New York Times. The unexpected afterlife of American communism. There's no communism in America, is there?
No. Well, just like the Washington Post seems to believe that North Korea has a point, the New York Times believes that the Communist Party USA has a point. They were founded in 1919, so in just 2 years from now, we can have a happy celebration on the radio, on the air here about how successful, influential they've been in this country. As an official party, of course, though, they haven't really gained too much traction, although their ideas big time have made traction. You can look at the candidacy of the Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders as a pretty pure evidence of that.
He made $1 million last year, by the way, at least.
Even though he hates rich people.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard when you just don't want this money and they keep giving it to me. It makes life difficult. So they think they have a point, the Communist Party in the U.S. This writer thinks they might have some sort of a point. What point do they have?
Well, this writer points out how the Communist throughout American history has been seen as the ultimate outside agitator. And while this writer does briefly admit that the Communist Party has been the Communist Party in America had been closely tied to the Soviet Union for a long time, this writer also points out how a lot of local radical organizing is also worthy of some credit here. It's also people on the ground who know the situation and who do deserve to have their voices heard.
Interesting. This comes from some of the same media outlets that are just beside themselves about a potential collusion between the current administration and Russia. And yet, in their opinion piece here, they think some of the ways that communism works it maybe is a good thing.
It's baffling, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's so many liberal ideas that directly contradict each other, but they don't even bother to explain the supposed contradictions. They just move right on like it's totally acceptable to justify communism in America, because apparently the Communist Party was usually the first group to point out how there was racism or police brutality. Police brutality has often been branded as connected to communism, and here the New York Times has explicitly stated that for us, so we don't even really need to try to prove that anymore. They've already given way and admitted that claiming police brutality is a communist tactic.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is if you look at the way Russia has been under communism and other nations too, there's not a lot of agitating. Once they're in charge, problems seem to disappear along with the agitators.
That's strange.
And no one talks about it. They're just, they're not around anymore. Isn't that been the history? I don't see a lot of protests in those nations, not ones at last.
Well, yeah, police brutality. I mean, the NKVD and then the KGB, the most infamous police brutality ever in history. I mean, just probably responsible for millions of people's deaths. So for any kind of communist organization, whether that be in America or wherever, the claim that any kind of American police has a problem, I mean, it's ignoring, like Grant said, a basic truth that the origins of those ideas, the origins of that party, are them guilty of what they're accusing America of. And it just makes no sense that they would have any kind of traction.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I obviously, the media, which is mostly very liberal, they have an agenda. They're trying to reshape the way people think. And with the North Korea piece that you're talking about, Abraham, and with this communism piece, it's almost like they're throwing out some really volatile thoughts, but just to see what people do about it. And then if there's not a big reaction, it seems like they're just going to push that line a little further. That's the way it seems to me. You know, to come out and say North Korea maybe has a point, what? Or to say, well, you know, there's some things about communism that are pretty good. Really? And then just, I think they're just looking to see what the response will be. And if no one goes after it, and there's no watchdog after all anymore, it seems like they just kind of keep kicking that line a little further ahead until they get their full ideas. And I think this is probably somewhat indicative of what the thinking is behind the scenes at some of those places.
That's exactly how this piece struck me. The first feeler that they put out there to see how receptive Americans might be toward the Communist Party in America, because they somehow believe it or not, they connected the Communist Party that started 98 years ago to the election that just took place a few months ago, and the way that Mr. Trump has supposedly demonized illegal immigrants and radical terrorists, because that's the exact same way that communists in America have been treated.
Hmm. Interesting. Did they get much response to their piece as far as comments?
It looks like, well, this only came out today, but there's already over 100 comments, and I didn't even read them yet, but I'm sure a lot of them were receptive. There were probably some that were shocked, because it's a little bit probably less than palpable for most liberals to jump full on into communism support. But I mean, that is where their ideas stem from and eventually lead to. So they do have to acknowledge that eventually.
It'd be maybe an interesting follow up for tomorrow. Just take a look and see like what some of the, what the response is to this.
Sure.
Idea.
I'll bring that back tomorrow.
Cause that's pretty, it's definitely a feeler, and, we'll see what people say. That's the New York Times, the unexpected afterlife of American communism. I don't know that it's unexpected. How about the planned underground attack of communism? That might be a better title.
For many decades, more than half a century at least. Obviously, even going back to this party's founding, the Soviet Union, and now even it looks like Russia is having some sort of an impact on American society. And it's also quite hypocritical that for as many ideas as liberals denounce as beyond the pale, they're representing something like this.
Yeah, it's the title makes it seem like, whoopsies, look what's still around.
We should give it a chance.
Yeah, hey, who knows? As if it hasn't been planned and been there for a long, long time. So there's a lot about that, and America Under Attack. It's a really good write-up at the booklet at thetrumpet.com. You should check that out. Abraham, you've got two stories to get to today. One you've been just dying to tell us about for a couple of days, and we've run out of time. Task and Purpose, the oldest living World War II veteran's secret to long life. I can't condone this, but he says his secret is whiskey and cigars. I don't mind a little whiskey here and there, but not the cigar.
Yeah, I just thought this was a really interesting piece, especially, I think today is especially interesting because this man is now 111 years old. Wow. He's the world's oldest World War II veteran, I believe, and he lives in Austin, Texas, and wow. His name is Richard Overton. And he has a really a lot of interesting tips on that, why he's so old and on his war experience. And I'll get to those in a second. But it's just good to, I think, look at veterans because they're not going to be around forever, especially on like a day like today, D-Day anniversary, and to talk with them and to listen to them, because once they die, that history dies with them. And we'll only have recordings and books and words. So it's good to go to living history whenever possible. And so this man, he's had an amazing lifespan. There's, in this article, if you can find it, or on YouTube, National Geographic did a little biography on him. It's about 12 minutes long, little documentary. They follow him around. And it's just fascinating. He's 100, at the time they made the documentary, he was 109. He's 111. He still walks on his own. He still drives himself. He drives a 1970 Ford F-150. And he said that, "I drive myself because those other drivers are crazy." That's a quote. And he said he was sitting on his porch with his M1 Grand, which is the rifle he used. He fought in the Pacific War. Uh-huh. He survived Pearl Harbor. Wow. And then he fought in many different battles in the Pacific. And he was sitting there with his M1 Grand just showing the camera. And he said, "Yeah, I don't lock any of my doors because I'm not afraid of nobody." It's like once you fought in the war, you're not afraid of anything anymore, and you shouldn't be. And he had a lot of compliments for the other soldiers that fought and died with him, that they learned how to be courageous in those experiences. And he still has that persona today, where he's not afraid of anyone, even though he's very old and he is frail, but he still has that spirit in him. And he has a very interesting diet. His house, if you look inside, it's like a stepping back to like the 40s, the 50s. Things haven't changed. He said he doesn't buy anything new if it doesn't need to be replaced. So he's all a bunch of old stuff, very well taken care of. He eats butter pecan ice cream every night. He drinks he smokes 5 or 6 cigars a day. Has a little bit of whiskey, and he says that those things just keep him happy. And that's, he said, once you start giving in to being old or frail or thinking you're not going to live much longer, that's when it gets you. So he's just staying positive, doing the things he likes until he can't do them anymore. And he's just a very positive person. And it's just amazing seeing how he lives and how independent he still is. And a lot of it's just because of his mindset.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, some of his habits might not be the best, but he is a positive guy, it seems like. And that, I think, has probably a lot to do, obviously, with his longevity. And just the fact that he, you know, he's never going to face anything as intense as what he went through when he was younger.
Yeah.
Like he said, what's there to worry about now? I mean, he's already faced probably the worst.
Yeah, and he's seen a lot in his life. I mean, he said the first car he bought was a Model T Ford, the ones you have to crank up in the front, like you get out and crank it in the front, yeah, and get it to run. That was his first car. I mean, he's seen so much American history. And one interesting thing he said was, a big way that he's lasted so long is because he had a spiritual life.
Yeah.
He goes to church regularly and he believes in God. And he said that's a big way where he's had peace of mind and in his own way. And I think that's an interesting point that he made, that a lot of the things not all of us can have the same lifestyle as him, but I think the overall principles are the same, being positive, doing things once in a while that make you happy, like that are, you enjoy, staying relaxed and just being confident in what you're doing is the right thing.
He's got to be getting close to oldest person in the world. It seems like there's always somebody that's up there like at 120 or something.
Yeah.
But they keep changing all the time because you can't hang around too much longer after that. Yeah, it is amazing to think about how much history he has seen. And for those who have read Herbert W. Armstrong's autobiography, the college we're broadcasting from is named after him. He lived a long time as well, into his 90s, and he saw, you know, he went from the horse and buggy age to the space age. And I guess beyond, if there is a beyond. I'm not sure what age we're in now, nuclear age. I'm not sure where we are. But yeah, you see so much change, and we haven't seen that much change in our lives, I guess. The internet, I suppose, but not really. You guys kind of always had the internet. That would be the biggest change, I guess, in my life would be internet and maybe cell phones. I don't know. But, you know, we haven't advanced as far as what they did over that 20th century.
Yeah. I mean, most of the technological advances have been the last 30 years, like internet, anything digital with microchips and all that. That's all been the past 30 years.
And Grant's a robot.
Yes, Android. So he's the first Android made by Android.
Awesome.
But
I've been exposed. Yeah.
But yeah, it's just I just encourage the listeners, if you have 12 minutes, to watch it, because it's just a really nice story, a happy story, and just something that honors his memory and something that just makes you feel good and gives everyone a little bit of hope that you can, if we do those things that stay positive, that we can have a long life as well.
How old was he when you were born?
When?
You were born.
Let's see.
Do a little math here.
He would have been
86, something like that, 85.
In his high 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Like your whole lifespan, and the guy was in his mid-80s when you were born.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You have one other write-up for us today from The Spectator. The newly refurbished National Army Museum is full of inaccuracies and post-colonial guilt. Which one are they talking about? Where is this at?
This is in Hospital Road, Chelsea, which is part of London.
Okay.
And it's they just did a £24 million refurbishing of the building, and they spruced it up a lot. And this is from Andrew Roberts, a historian, and I just think he brings up a lot of interesting points. Because he used to like going to the National Army Museum. It had 400 years of history there,
mm-hmm,
of the British Army, and it didn't have any message in it. It was just, chronologically, it took you through the history of the Army, medals, weapons, uniforms, paintings. And so the person who visits it can decide for themselves what to take. There's no message being pushed.
Right.
But that's all changed, and he's pretty disappointed. In fact, Andrew Roberts visited this museum on the morning of his wedding. He liked it so much. So, I mean, for him, it had a lot of...
Was he expecting a war ahead?
I don't know.
Getting married? Or
get some inspiration. But yeah, and now it's completely changed, and they have a lot of political messages. They don't take you through it chronologically anymore. There's themes now. Society, army, what you can vote on, what you think the future of the army should be, whether it's nation building, peacekeeping, fighting terrorism. There's no option that says defend Great Britain from our enemies.
Yep.
That's not an option. But some of the most outrageous ones, on a wall in huge letters, it says, "Troops from the colonies didn't always have a say in fighting for the British Army, and even slaves have been used to fight on our behalf." So that's a big banner on the wall when, as he points out, it's very rare that actually happened. That prisoners were used and different people, but slaves were only used in West India. And most of the other peoples, like from India proper and other places, were volunteers. And they happily fought for Britain at those times. And so it's just a huge shame. You're shaming the whole British Army because of, I mean, a couple poor decisions, but you're completely overshadowing the sacrifice and the wars they fought to defend the empire and the people they were fighting with from a far worse enemy. And so it's just, as he says, very apologetic, and it's trying to push this colonial guilt on the people, saying, like, well, you should be ashamed of your of the British Empire for what they did because they're all slave owners and racist and all that, when that it completely misses the point that the British Army is a very proud thing you should be proud of, because longer than the United States, they've been fighting for our rights of constitution and of freedom for a long time.
It's interesting when you look at something like this, you know, or you'd see it in any probably major university. There's a very, and the media today, there's a very specific agenda, which is anti-West. And you just have to stop and think, well, who are the decision makers here? Like, who can decide to do that? You know, if we are supposed to be democracies on some level, and somebody wants to do this, you would think it should be proposed, and people should be able to have their say, and there should be back and forth about it, and historians should be able to weigh in. I don't know what the process is, but it just seems like, oh, we're just going to overhaul this museum, and we're going to throw our ideology in there. Well, who decided? Like, who approved that? That's what I'm always interested in, getting back to the roots of that, because it's coming from a very specific place, and the whole goal is to undermine any Western values.
That museum exposes a perversion of history. The whole purpose of history is to record and preserve and retell events in a chronological order, not to inject ideology into it. For example, a really popular history book is Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. It's almost 800 pages that tells the history of the U.S. as if its whole purpose has been to oppress minorities and other historically afflicted groups. He tells about how white people went into an Indian village and slaughtered all the people, conveniently leaving out the part where they had been going back and forth for a while, and that the native people had just right before that gone into a white village and done the same exact thing to them, and worse, you know, barbarically scalping them, putting their heads on pikes, things like that. He even admitted he's a socialist communist sympathizer. He sympathized with the Stalin regime, and he said that he believed his purpose was to put his ideology, his belief system, into his history because he wanted to shape people's minds.
We are descending into an age of darkness, because here you have this museum that's supposed that did show some of the history of the West and the battles, and now it's being very much become just a place to go to be radicalized and be against the British Empire. But then you talked about before, a few weeks back, about how in Russia, well, the Gulag museums are all being closed. Nobody wants to talk about that history anymore. And so because I was just thinking, okay, if you want to sit there and take sort of this high-minded approach of, well, we need to highlight all the evils that Britain did, the British Empire or America did, what nation are you going to go to and set up a museum where you can't show the evils that were done in that land? Where are you going to go to? Was the rest of the world the utopian paradise before the British Empire? Is that what I'm supposed to believe? Because from what I've read, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. Just that the way we remember our history is starting to resemble Russia more than what it used to be. I mean, and that's a huge shame. I mean, that's a crime, in fact, that history is being changed, rewritten, and revised for a specific political purpose. And that's exactly what Putin does. That's what Kim Jong-un does. There's a museum in North Korea depicting when Americans killed 34,000 North Koreans, which isn't true. But they have a whole museum on that to try to indoctrinate North Koreans that hate Americans. China, they have the Museum of the Great Patriotic War Against America, where they have it's a museum about the Korean War and how America invaded North Korea and was killing people and how China stepped in and saved them. I mean, that's the education of these other countries. And that's basically what we're seeing now, except we're apologizing for our history and we're saying, well, yeah, they're right. We've been evil, and China, North Korea, Russia, they're actually right. We should make museums in their image.
Well, and how can on one hand, in the aftermath of a terror attack, can the media say, well, look at our proud history. We stood up to the Nazis. And then you have a museum where you say, well, everything you did to defend yourselves or to fight, it was wrong. Which one is it? Should they have just surrendered to the Nazis? Because that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the cartoon with the spectator piece here is it shows a picture of Churchill, and it says the Churchill War-Monger exhibit. Because that's basically what's implying, is that these sort of things happen. They have this is what it says here, what Andrew Roberts writes. The National Army Museum, it boasts, challenges you to think again about what an army museum is. And he says, why should it? Why can't it just be a museum that houses the paraphernalia of the National Army? Why does it have to be this big thing where it's challenging you to think about what a museum is, why it should be there, why the army should exist? I mean, what's the point? I mean, there are lots of great museums in Britain and other places, but that's because they're actually museums. They're not indoctrination houses you go to get a left-leaning slant on history. And this is on it. And if a veteran went there, they'd be ashamed of it, because no politician is going to say a veteran, oh, you're a warmonger, you were evil. But that's what they're implying by building these kinds of museums.
I always love it when they say, we're going to challenge you to think differently. What they're really saying is, would you believe this lie?
Yeah.
We're going to challenge you to think differently. We're just going to lie to you and see what you think about it. See if you'll believe it. That's from the Spectator. The newly refurbished National Army Museum is full of inaccuracies and post-colonial guilt. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Key David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming your way. For myself, Dwight Folk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, thanks for joining us. We'll see you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.